Small Town Podcast is made possible by generous support from the Georgia Municipal Association. GMA supports Georgia cities. Small Town Podcast is supported by Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company. Consolidated Pipe is a full-line supplier of products for the water, wastewater, and natural gas industries, and they serve utilities and public works departments in cities, large and small, every day. They're the exclusive distributor of Master Meter AMI-AMR technology. As a family-owned company with a legacy that began in 1960, let Consolidated Pipe show you that they are dedicated to service.
I hereby call this episode to order.
Hey, small towners, it's Mayor Matt Seal, and thanks for joining me for another episode of Small Town Podcast. So today we're going to do things a little differently. Normally I would go explore and share a small town somewhere else, but we're not supposed to be doing that right now. Now, I've wanted to discuss the topic of rural healthcare for quite some time. So today we're staying in the great city of Osceola, and we're going to talk to someone who can give us a great perspective on this topic, thanks to his wealth of knowledge and experience. We're going to go talk to Dr. Howard McMahon in my small town of Osceola, Georgia. Come go with me.
Growing up in coastal Georgia, I only thought I lived in a small town. Soon as I graduated high school, I moved to the big city of Atlanta for college and to start my life. My life is a journey, and I ended up in Osceola, Georgia. Population 3,400. We've got two traffic lights here. We're not looking to get a third anytime soon. Some years later, the people of Osceola made me their mayor. Man, I love living in a small town. Other folks do too. This is the Small Town Podcast, and I'm your host, Mayor Matt Seal of the great city of Osceola, Georgia.
Small Town Podcast is sponsored by Public Software. While the name may sound new, Public Software has been helping small towns, cities, counties, and utility districts for over 50 years. They provide integrated software to help manage utility billing, accounting, and additional services. They help organizations accurately calculate, collect, and distribute money, print and mail statements, and effectively manage budgets. Some say they are a B2B company, but Public Software is focused on H2H, human-to-human connections. With decades of proven success and reliable service, let them make your software applications work seamlessly with the human interactions in your community. You can learn more about Public Software and what they can do for you and your organization by visiting www.publicsoftware.com. That's www.publicsoftware.com. Public Software. Strong relationships, stronger communities. All right, well, I'm at the doctor's office. I didn't go very far this time for this episode. I'm in the great city of Osceola, and I'm in the office of Dr. Howard McMahon, who affectionately known as Dr. Mac around the great city of Osceola. So, Dr. Mac, thanks for joining us on Small Town Podcast.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And usually people say, Mr. Mayor, welcome to whatever city, but I'm the mayor, so you don't have to welcome me to my own city this time. There's a lot going on right now, and like I mentioned to you, I've been interested in having a conversation with you about rural healthcare in general, but obviously healthcare and wellness are very mainstream as a topic with COVID-19. And so we'll talk a little bit about that, of course, but I just really want to talk about kind of some of the differences and challenges in rural healthcare with your experience and what some of the opportunities beyond Osceola that you've had as far as boards and associations that you've been a big part of. But I don't want to lose my manners and not try to get to know you a little bit and let our audience get to know you a little bit. And I know some of the answers to these questions, but I'm interested to learn a little more. So I'll start with my first question that I always ask all my local officials when I go to their town. Were you born in Osceola, Georgia?
I was not.
Well, let's start where you began then. Where were you born and raised?
I am an Army brat of two Western South Carolinians. My father was in the U.S. Army, was born in New Jersey, at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. As an Army brat, traveled around a little bit. So I was less than a year old when my father was transferred to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, where we lived for a year, and then to Fort Gordon in Augusta. That was my first trip, or foray, if you will, into the state of Georgia, state of Georgia, which we now call home. Lived there for 2 years, then got to travel across the seas to the island of Formosa, nationalist China and Taiwan. Lived there for 2 years when I was 4 and 5. Have a few recollections. Most of them have probably been picked by home movies that my mother loved to take when we were there, including a major typhoon, including my father's company softball team and the uniform that he had his tailor make for me. As a four-year-old kid, I thought that was really cool. What was not really cool was a bomb shelter in our backyard and the monthly air raid exercises that all of the dependents and all of the military at that time went through on a regular basis.
Wow. Wow. So you've been around a couple places, and you said that was just when you were 4 or 5.
4 and 5. And then back to Georgia for 2 years, first and second grade in Grovetown Elementary School in Grovetown, Georgia.
Yep, that's near
Augusta.
Which
was a population of about 400 people at that time, and it's now exploded as Augusta and Fort Gordon have expanded tremendously. And then from there to Germany, we lived in Stuttgart, Germany, patch barracks up on one side of the valley, Stuttgart, the major city in the valley, and then Berlingen on the opposite side where we were bused to school. So those of you who have complained about busing issues, this was done out of necessity in military schools or American schools for overseas dependents.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful time there. Made a couple of trips with my dad through East Germany, Checkpoint Charlie, Berlin, which was an educational experience also.
Sure.
It's helped to, of course, coming from conservative South Carolinians, Scott-Irish heritage, and then being an Army brat, a military brat, and seeing the world, or at least parts of the world, gives me a little bit different perspective than most people who are locally born and grown and thrived their entire lives here in rural South Georgia.
Yeah. So with all that moving around, where did you end up graduating high school? That's usually when people move around. That's usually where I get
Great question. Harlem High School in Harlem, Georgia.
Okay.
Which is about 20 miles just west of Augusta.
So you ended up in Augusta, the Augusta area, I should say, a few times.
My father did two tours at Fort Gordon.
Okay.
Of course, he was in the Signal Corps after his combat duties. He did get smart, a little smarter after his two tours in Korea, that he didn't want to be an infantryman any longer.
Yeah.
So he changed his MOS and was a Signal Corps radio and telecommunications expert.
Okay.
So after he retired from the military, we were living in Fort Bragg, North Carolina at the time. We retired and moved back to the Grovetown area where he had bought property and a house and went to school in the 7th grade there in Grovetown and then morphed into the middle school program and high school program in Harlem, as Grovetown did not have a middle school, high school after 7th grade.
But with all that moving, you at least went to high school in the same place all 4 years.
The first time in my life, I actually went to the same school for 5 years in a row.
Yeah.
Actually had friends for longer than a year or two. Really, that was where I grew up. And that's where, with all of the experiences, I think those 5 years in Harlem High School with the same friends and fellow classmates was a very important aspect of making me who I am.
Yeah. I actually, growing up in Hinesville near Fort Stewart, I stayed still. I went to school there the entire time in Liberty County, but my friends rotated out about every 2 or 3 years because of the military base there. So there were some of us, though. I think there was a pretty small group of us that were, you know, in the same class from kindergarten all the way through, and everyone else kind of rotated out. So, but at least I got to be stationary. Everything.
Very good.
So after high school, what then? Did you already know you wanted to get into the medical profession?
I did. Sometime early in my junior year in high school, I thought that I wanted to be a medical doctor. I did 10 hours of classwork after my junior year in high school. I had an early enrollment at Augusta College, that is now Augusta University, made A's in English 101, which was the course that typically determined whether you were college material or not, least at Augusta College. And I owe my ability to to write and to perform and function in the English language world with one of my teachers in high school, Alton F. Barnes, who is retired United States Army colonel, Fulbright colonel, did his college education at West Point.
Okay.
And he was a large, well-built man, very booming voice. He was 6'4", 6'5", about 250 pounds. No one, including the football players, tried to intimidate him at all. He was, with his background, unintimidable, but had a great skill with the English language, but also had great skills in teaching others. One of my heroes. He taught freshman English and he taught junior English. So I had him twice.
Okay.
And so with early enrollment, I also earned a scholarship at Augusta College. I also, with that in my PSAT score and upcoming subsequent SAT scores, got me an early enrollment at Georgia Tech to skip my, before it became fashionable, to skip my senior year in high school
now
and
cool.
to go to Georgia Tech.
Now all the kids are doing it.
But I didn't do that. I had such a good time that summer in Augusta and with my friends and a cute little redhead with green eyes that I was very fond of and very friendly. We went to church together. We were in class together. We sat in alphabetical order. That was just the rule of the school.
Yep.
So we spent a lot of time together in the classroom, of course, and in church, training union, Sunday school, et cetera. I sort of caved in and let my scholarly activities, let them play out a little bit. So I went to high school my senior year in the mornings, and then I would take a course in the afternoons in Augusta. So I would drive to Augusta College and further my college education as a high school senior.
But even then, you knew you wanted to go into the practice of medicine.
I did. My pre-med advisor, who was the head of the biology department, Dr. John Black, was also on faculty at the Medical College of Georgia. He was a geneticist, had a number of businesses, but also, as I said, was faculty at the medical college. So he was very instrumental in solidifying my intentions of going to medical school and becoming a doctor.
So you finished at Augusta College and then stayed in the Augusta area to go to Medical College of Georgia.
I did.
After all that moving around as a young man, you decided you want to stay in one place for a little while?
Very much so.
I mean, obviously it was a good school to go to.
I liked the stability and I liked the relationships.
Sure,
And I think that shows that developing relationships, long-standing relationships, and really getting to know people was something that I longed for.
Yeah.
That we did not have I did not have the opportunity as a child.
Sure.
Until, again, the seventh and eighth grade. So I took full advantage of that. And I think that also is what drove me or led me into primary care and family medicine, which was a new specialty at the time, specifically.
So when you graduated med school, what did you do next, and what was kind of factored in that the decision making process? Because I want to kind of take us through the journey of how you ended up in Osceola, because Osceola hasn't entered the picture at this point in the story.
Right. Well, my senior year in medical school, I was asked by a number of faculty professors, MDs. I was particularly good at internal medicine, good in family medicine. My interest, because I had allergies and nasal problems and sinus problems as a kid, I had a real interest in otorhinolaryngology, ear, nose, and throat disorders. I did a mandatory two-week rotation with the ENT team and faculty and got to know them pretty well, including Newton Quantz, who is the upcoming chief resident. I did an elective with ENT department my senior year, met all of my credits for graduation 2.5 to 3 months before graduation date. And was Dr. Quantz had me go into the chairman of the department's office. They wanted to talk to me. They were short an intern, and I had impressed them adequately to where they wanted to pay me an internship for 2 months to basically be a working substitute intern for them. That was quite an opportunity because up till then, I was paying out all sorts of money that I had to borrow to get there.
Yeah.
And so for the last 2.5 months, I was actually being paid for what I did.
Oh, nice
change.
Instead
of me paying to do it.
Yeah.
Dr. Perubsky had a signed contract that he handed across his desk and said, Howard, we want you to stay with us. You don't go through the match. you're too good, quote unquote, you're too good of a doctor to go into family medicine. I said, well, thank you, Dr. Berubsky, but that's my passion. That's my joy. And that's what I want to do. I think that's what I was born to do, is to be a small town family doc. But I do appreciate him thinking of me and offering me that opportunity.
It's nice to have options. That speaks well of you and your skills and what you'd been able to show everybody as far as your talent.
It goes back to relationships.
Sure.
And part of that is my genetic makeup, being Scott-Irish, very clannish. But I've always liked people. I like to get to know people. What makes them tick? Where do they come from? What's important to them? And that those... I think those skills helped me along my way in my training, my education, and the experience I've had in practicing family medicine in a number of locations. So to further the story, I interviewed at 10 different family medicine residency programs across the country, not just in Georgia, not just in the Southeast.
Okay.
But I was really interested in the family medicine program at the medical center. It's now called the Columbus Medical Center. But at the time, it was the medical center in Columbus, Georgia. C. Dan Cabanis was the director of medical education, and he had trained at Emory, but had developed a faculty of very skilled and accomplished specialists to run all of his various departments. But they had a very strong family medicine program. And the thing that I liked the most was it was full service. There were no other residencies there. It was just family medicine. So when I was on pediatric call, I was a pediatrician. When I was on OB call, I was the obstetrician gynecologist. Same way in the ER, same way in surgery, same way in internal medicine, same way in intensive care. We rotated through all of those and had expert hands-on education and training and procedural training as well.
Yeah.
At that time, which even though it was new, the newest specialty, if you will, there were so many programs that did not get the hands-on experience with doing invasive procedures, those sorts of things. And that's what I wanted to do, because I knew that I wanted to live in a small town and would likely not have the specialty support immediately available. And I would be delivering babies. I would be putting in chest tubes. I would be diagnosing and treating, managing people with heart attacks. And,
you knew there'd be a lot less specialization because
I had to know a little bit about everything.
Yeah,
I had to have some hands-on skills to do a number of things.
Yeah.
And that was the program that gave us the opportunity.
So once you finished that, where did you end up? And I'm curious, even before you answer this, what was it about a small town? And now Grovetown, even though you said it exploded, it's still a small town by most standards.
Grovetown and Harlem, very small town.
So you'd been to so many different places. You'd been in, I mean, Stuttgart's a pretty big city in Germany. You talked about some of the other places you've been to that were large and small. So what was it about a small town that kind of drew you into that, especially with your chosen profession?
Relationship with people in the population.
Close-knit feeling.
Close-knit.
Sense of community.
You knew their mother. You knew their father. You knew their interest in life. I was just drawn to that. And again, I think it may be clannish. It may be genetics again. So early on, as we go back to, I guess, my seventh grade year on, and then having the continuity and exposure to the same people for a number of years, I was very, very fond of that. I appreciated that immensely.
Yeah.
Instead of having a friend for 6 months and then they left, or either I left and did not have many long-term friendships as a child, as a military brat, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. So once you were done with your residency in Columbus— where did you end up next?
Well, I interviewed in a number of small communities and ended up going to Washington, Georgia in Wilkes County.
Okay, yep. We've been there on this podcast.
Yes, yes. Well, it was halfway between Athens, closest to Thompson, but not that far, about an hour from Augusta and my family and my wife's family, and about 45 minutes to an hour from Athens and Atlanta, not too far away. And we were heavily recruited with one of my residency friends, Dr. Dennis Thomas, who now practices in Valdosta, but he and I went to Washington together. And we were not very busy. There were four other doctors at the time in a small hospital, and my partner became bored quicker than I did. And we were hoping to generate a profitable business there. We built an office, invested a good bit of money, and Dr. Thomas was a little bit bored. So he was invited to come to Adel, Georgia with his former father-in-law, Dr. Russell Akrey in Adel, who needed some help. And Dennis spent 2 weeks working with him just to cover some time when Dr. Acree's partner was gone.
Right.
And Dennis came back to Washington and said, Dr. Acree has just bought the hospital. They have more patients than they can handle. We would be busy. He says, I'm leaving. I want you to go with me. I was reluctant to pick up and go and move my family again. At that time, Janet and I had, my wife's name is Janet, of course.
Is that redhead you were
That's
talking
about? That's the redhead with the green eyes, yeah. Beautiful young lady that become my partner in life. We had three children. Our oldest, Hank, was still in diapers and, well, actually probably more of a toddler then, but she was a little bit reluctant to pick up again and make another move, except for the bottom line. The bottom line was we paid off all of our medical school debt. We basically took care of the cost of the practice. But outside of those requirements, we basically lived off of $1,000 or less a month with a wife and three children.
Yeah.
And when Dr. Acree flew his plane up to Washington and Dennis came with him, and when they offered a substantial salary and said, on the spot, I'll write you a check right now.
Come on, I'll give you money and we'll be busy. Yeah.
He said, and we need the help.
Yeah.
So I was mulling the dilemma over in my mind, and Janet said, there's no question. We're coming.
We're going to Adel, baby.
I haven't made up my mind yet. And she said, we have made up our mind.
She made it up for you,
So we have these three children. We need to do something differently.
Good
so
opportunity,
South Georgia.
But Adel just is another small town. Our population, I think, would be a bit bigger than Washington, if I remember correctly. But not a metropolis.
No, a little bit bigger. I think at the time Washington was still, I guess someone would say, thriving a little bit better than what it has done since then. So we're talking about the 83, 84, 85, and that. So we were in Adel in August of 84. And there were four of us, and we all did OB. We all did some degree of surgeries. Dr. Acree was an accomplished surgeon, even though he's family medicine. But he had learned his skills practicing in Hayhira, Georgia.
Yep. Another small town not too far from here.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Dr. Jesse Parrott was his partner there. Well-loved and renowned family doc for decades in that small community.
Yeah.
And Russell practiced with him there, and then when he bought the hospital in Adel, transferred his practice to Adel as well.
Well, it sounds like things were set up for you. So how did we get from Adel to Ocilla? Because I'm pretty sure that's the next move.
Again, Dr. Acree was a mover and shaker, and he knew that the hospital in Ocilla was in trouble. He had helped to bail out the Hayhira Hospital and actually took over ownership of that. And I'm not sure who it was in it. And this is my age, but I cannot remember specifically who was the chairman of the county commission, who was also serving as the chairman of the hospital board, but contacted Dr. Acree that they needed some financial help, or they would be willing to sell the hospital. And of course, that was Dr. Acree's interest. He offered me ownership in the hospital, and for the that would be given to me if I would transfer my practice or move to Ocilla and take over the hospital and basically be the one doctor here. And I didn't really want to do that, not with my family having to be relocated again.
Right.
But then an old friend of mine, medical school classmate, residency mate, next door neighbor, who was practicing in Moultrie at the time, Dr. Eugene Hooks Jackson, you may recall Dr. Jackson, I ran the idea by him, and he said, well, Howard, I think that's a great idea. We ought to do that. So he convinced his wife, and Janet was still not convinced, called Billy Sams. He was the lone practicing doctor at the time, and just asked him if I could come up and meet with him. So he said, sure, I'm in my office until late at night, but you just come up to my office, and I'll take you around and show you the town, and we'll go to the hospital. That evening, I did. I drove up to Ocilla and met with Dr. Sams, and we talked for a good while, went through the hospital, went through the nursing home, and I was pleased with what I saw. Small, close-knit community in need of medical care. It just struck a chord with me that that's what I had been trained to do, to provide full-service care to a population in a small rural area with limited resources.
Yeah. And what year was that you came to Ocilla?
That was 1990, November of 1990.
Okay.
So it was late October, evening in late October when I met with Dr. Sams. So the coming weekend was the sweet potato festivities. And so when I went home, and Dr. Sams had told me, be sure to bring your wife and your kids to the sweet potato festival, and you'll get an idea of what the community is like. And so we did that. And Janet was very favorably impressed. The following morning, of course, we drove back to Adale. But on Sunday, we came to Osillon. We went to the Methodist Church. We were Methodist in Adale, but just wanted to see what was going on in the church life, et cetera. And I don't know if Dr. Sams had prepared somebody within the within the congregation.
They knew you were coming. It was a recruiting tool, huh?
That's right, as a recruiting tool. But we were met with great interest and many people offering to take us to lunch that day.
And
we met a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, that probably would have happened anyway, because that's just kind of the culture
small
we live in.
Do.
That's right. But I'm sure they knew who you were when you walked in the door, even if you didn't know who they were.
Even though we tried to be incognito and and go under the
you should know better.
The radar.
You've been in small towns already.
That's right. I think somebody tipped off the cops, if you will.
Well, so we've gone through your story, and already there's some interesting themes, and at this point, I usually go a very different direction because we often talk about whatever community that I'm talking about and profiling with the episode. So we've got COVID-19 going on. You've already actually touched on, because I already know, people that are listening to this that are thinking big city ways of doing things, you know, a big corporation owns a hospital. And you just gave two examples, in Adale and Osillon, of where a local doctor comes in and maybe two doctors or you know, in one scenario there, one doctor was going to be the main hospital doctor, owns the hospital, has ownership in it, and that may be foreign to some folks, but that's the way it has to be done a little differently. You had a hospital authority run by county commissioners that was willing to sell the hospital, not because they were just trying to unload it, but because it was in trouble. We needed to make sure someone came to practice, and that wasn't it. So we can go in several different directions about rural healthcare. So I'll just ask it this way, just to be general. Talk about some of the challenges. You've already talked about kind of the stretched resources, but you've been in Osillon 30 years, coming up on 30 years by the coming in October at the Sweet Potato Festival.
That's right.
And you had experiences in at least two other small towns. And then, of course, you know, I'm sure you've had multiple experiences and knowledge because of you're so well networked with other physicians. But just generally discuss what the challenges are in rural healthcare.
Well, just for accuracy's sake, Dr. Eckery actually did not buy the hospital, but formed a corporation to manage the hospital. There were certain tax advantages with it remaining a Hill-Burton County Authority run facility.
Mm-hmm. Now that hospital authority still exists in Irving County
today.
And still does that.
Today.
Yeah,
and,
but just that was even talked about was probably foreign to some people.
So Vernon Biggers, who was a church member and also on the governing authority or the hospital authority and on the county commission at the time, he's also a patient of mine, but he's always credited himself as being the responsible person for bringing me to Osillon, Irwin County.
That's good. That speaks highly of you. That means he wants credit. If you'd done a bad job and everyone didn't want you here, then no one would want to claim credit.
the proverbial response to that would be run out of town on a rail.
On a rail. That's right. That's right.
Or tar and feathered. That's
nope.
Correct.
No. You've been here. Obviously, made yourself a critical part of the community and.
The hospital was one day away from being out of funds. Dr. Eckery, before the ink dried, actually infused $200,000 into the bank account of the hospital.
Yeah.
And I rented a house, totally vacated, in town, and basically lived here for 2 weeks, sleeping on a mattress on the floor with nothing else in the house.
Just to get things
going.
While
my family was still in Adale at the time.
Yeah.
And basically saw patients in the little office building. Actually, we started seeing patients in the hospital, covered the emergency room and all of rounded on the patients, which were few, but started to increase in number before the end of the first week, actually. Mm-hmm. So I was the old Doc Hollywood, if you will, doing everything for everybody all the time.
Yeah.
It was literally all of the time for 2 weeks. Dr. Jackson could not, who did agree to come and join me, but he could not physically be available for 2 weeks at least. So I took call 24/7 for 14 days straight.
You just referenced, you know, a $200,000 infusion that was absolutely necessary in 1990.
Yes.
You and I both know that there was a similar on the brink kind of thing just a few years ago. And Irwin County Hospital is not alone. So to suggest, you know, I want to make sure that no one thinks, oh, man, there's mismanagement or misdeeds or anything going on in Irwin County. We're on a list, a long list, unfortunately, of rural hospitals that just seem to constantly be on the brink. So for that to have happened in 1990 and also still be an issue today, that just seems to be a real issue that no one's figured out a solution for. So as simply as possible, and it's not a simple thing, describe the issue that kind of creates those financial crunches for rural hospitals.
Well, there are a number of issues, and I'm going to forget to mention several of them. of course.
The biggest ones we'll get.
Well,
like I said, I know there's a lot of variables, so it's a complex problem. Otherwise, we'd have had it figured out by now. But just for education purposes, hit some of the highlights.
We'll start with payer mix. In rural areas, there's certainly more patients, an older population, if you will, as well. Proportionately larger number of patients on Medicare, Medicaid, which historically, at least back in those days, were paying less than commercial insurance was paying. So we did have some businesses, we did have some commercially covered patients with insurance, but just the amount of capital that could be generated was limited, just not only by the small number of patients, but also by the payer mix coverage, if you will. So it was difficult to attract specialty care, and that's why family physicians, generalists who could do more than one thing at the time were necessarily required in these small communities.
The Doc Hollywoods like yourself?
Like myself, yeah. I delivered babies. Dr. Jackson and I delivered babies, quite a number of those while we were here, just like Billy Sams did, and just like a number of the revered physicians, Dr. Herman Dismuke and Dr. Mixon, there were so many others that came before us that did the same thing. And that was back in the day when they were paid by eggs, chickens, watermelons, et cetera. And I came in on the tail end of that as I had a patient come by the office and left me a pickup truckload of watermelons. And now, what was a young doc like me going to do with a pickup load of watermelons? Didn't know, but he said, look, I can't pay you anything, but here you can have these watermelons or you can sell them, whatever you want to do with them.
Then you have to hire someone to sell your watermelons while you continue to practice so that you can get chickens and eggs and whatever else.
That's where Janet came in. She was pretty intuitive and resourceful in so many different ways of making that work for us.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it could be a pickup load of watermelons or a mess of catfish.
Yeah.
Well, I'll pay you next time, Doc, but here, take these home for the little lady.
There you go. How else is it different? I mean, that's a striking example right there of things, but what else makes it different to practice in a small town than what things might be like in a more metropolitan area with higher population density? And maybe that's some of what's going on with some of the struggles financially, but just differences overall.
Limited resources. So as a family physician with a broad range of education, training, and experience, it was still somewhat daunting. Again, we did full obstetrics. When I say we, Dr. Jackson and I did an additional 3 months of training in advanced obstetrics, learning some surgical skills. And of course, in 3 months, you're not going to have the amount of experience that you need. But in the time that I was in ADL for 6.5 years, again, with 4 and then 5 family docs, we did an awful lot of obstetrics with Dr. Acree and Dr. Morgan being the two older physicians helping us and teaching us hands-on. And as I had referred, Dr. Acree was a quite an accomplished surgeon in his own right, even as a family physician. But that was the way that in the Old South that many generalists did a number of procedures. And going back to Dr. Herman Dismuke, I've heard stories about him with physicians at Emory actually calling Dr. Dismuke to come up and teach them how to do a procedure that he had been doing in rural South Georgia.
Yeah.
I don't know how truthful that is, but it makes a good story anyway. But he was considered an accomplished surgeon in the state and in the region. practicing in Ocilla, Georgia.
Yeah. Well, don't sell yourself short. You've made some quite a name for yourself throughout the country. You were featured in Parade magazine. Now they picked you for that article. How many years ago was that? I remember that because you actually the photo shoot was in my cafe, so we made sure to put it up to say, yeah, that's right. The celebrity lives here.
That's correct. The interview was done in the fall of 2012, and the article came out March the 3rd of 2013.
And they chose you because of your involvement with an organization. So talk about that and kind of some of the discussions that took place there.
Well, even with a busy practice, I was active in the Georgia Academy of Family Physicians, which is basically the state chapter of the National Academy, those of us who are board certified in family medicine.
So it's just family medicine practices.
Right, just family medicine. And I'm trying to remember when I first became a member of the AAFP and the GAFP. I know the GAFP was just three or 400 members strong. We're now in the Georgia chapter up over 2,500 members, closer to 3,000 family physicians. Nationally, there are 140,000 family physicians that are AAFP members. I served in many capacities at the state level. Chairman of a number of committees, including membership and member services. I was Speaker of the Congress of Delegates, Vice Speaker for a number of years, Speaker in training for at least 5 years, was the Speaker of the Congress of Delegates and served on the Board of Directors for the state chapter, the Georgia Academy of Family Physicians. And then I served as President of the Academy 2008 through 2009. I was chairman of the board of directors 2009 through 2010, and remained in senior leadership at the state level, and was selected to a commission on quality and practice at the national level with the American Academy of Family Physicians. Served for 3 years with them, and as part of one of my duties being a small town, rural-based family doc, I was one of five physicians nationally that served on the rural health group. And I guess that's what led me to be one of the five potential focuses of the article of small town family docs.
That's right. In the conversations, you're dealing with, you know, people across the country, you know, so are there similarities and differences between small towns, or a lot of the things more the same than different as far as, I mean, I would imagine things like lack of resources and population scarcity and things like that would be similar enough that they'd have the same challenges. But were there some things that were maybe unique to a certain state or anything like that? I'm just curious.
There are some subtle differences, but for the most part, it's very similar. What the author said led to her choosing me, well, she called and interviewed me telephonically. But I was not so young as to be immature and naive. I had some history behind me, but I was not so old as to be decrepit, middle age at the time. I still did a full service independent practice, so I was not employed by a hospital or by an agency or a health system, and was still doing it the old-fashioned way. I ate what I was able to kill or raise. In that old-fashioned term, but so they came, meaning the writer and the photographer came and spent 2 days in South Georgia.
And what were they most interested in capturing, or what did you want to make sure you got across to them? And hopefully what you wanted to get across is what came across when the article was released.
Well, a couple of things. One is that family medicine is a viable specialty and a very necessary specialty that many people downplay. And many of my specialty colleagues have not felt that it was really worthwhile. In a community like this, there is no way that a surgeon would have stayed here. There's no way that an internal medicine or a cardiologist or a pulmonologist or a nephrologist or a pediatrician by themselves could have stayed here and taken care of the needs of the population, nor generated the type of income, the level of income that they would have expected.
Yeah.
So I was able to share that with them, that by being a jack of all trades and a master of none, but pretty good at most of those things,
right,
at a particularly above average level, that family physicians do provide necessary benefits and services and skills in rural areas.
Yeah, have to. But there's no other way to do it, or at least not another practical way to do it.
And they were they were intrigued by the fact that I could deliver a baby, take care of the newborn baby, and as they got older, take care of the mother and the father, take care of the brother and the sisters, take care of the aunts and uncles, take care of the grandparents, and all the same doctor taking care of everybody.
The whole spectrum.
But that's the value of family medicine and the value of the education and training experience that I had gotten.
Talk about, you've actually kind of alluded to this with the eggs and the watermelons and everything, because you're independent practice for most of your career, you have been, the balancing act between your primary goal is to provide care. And I think people can hear it, your voice just talking, but if they need any reassurance, I can reassure everybody in the audience that you are very passionate about really providing quality care. But there's a business aspect of that too. So that creates the extra need for the family practice as opposed to the specialization that just can't be sustained in a small area. But speak to that a little bit.
It does. And to illustrate that it was truly in the early days, it was family practice. We then matured a little bit and became a little uppity and changed the specialty to family medicine. But in our experience here, I did have a number of office managers that, and they were basically billing clerks. We set the practice up to do what I was taught in my residency, and that's basically to take care of people. So the entire staff was focused on the patient and focused on the needs of the patient. And I'll go back even further. There are some differences in medical education, training, experience, and the business model today based on the day I started medical school in 1976. Day number one, when I walked into the Medical College of Georgia, onto that campus, we were taught rule number one, do no harm. Rule number two, do all the good you can possibly do. Rule number three, you do no harm. Always go back to rule number one.
Right, okay? Right.
And then the focus all through my freshman year was you need to learn the basic sciences so that you can better understand what's going on with your patients and how you as a physician can intervene and care for them. But in the clinical setting, as third-year students, some as late second-year students, when we started doing clinical rounds in the clinics and in the hospital, the message was uniformly, listen to the patient. The patient's story is the most important element you need to provide the appropriate care for that patient at the time. And don't be afraid to develop a relationship with the patient. I have to say that that's changed over the decades, and it's certainly not that way now. Money was never talked about. We were told that if you practice good medicine, if you complete your education, you do appropriate training, and you apply yourself, you will be financially taken care of. Not wealthy, you won't be in the Fortune 500 list,
right.
But you'll be taken care of. And those of us that went into primary care truly believe that. And most of our colleagues, most of our classmates did as well, even those who went into neurosurgery, if you will. But most of us in primary care knew that we would be taken care of, but our focus should be on caring for the patients in our community. And that was just, it was almost universal. I won't say 100%, but certainly in the high 90s, that was our focus. It was easy to develop relationships in communities when you truly cared about people and you wanted to know about their mamas and their daddies and about their children or their aunts and uncles and what they did in the community. It's about relationships.
I want to shift a little bit. I told you this was an episode I've been interested in doing for a while. Just talk about rural health care, and I very much respect your opinion and your experience. And I knew that you would be a wealth of knowledge on the perspective that you've already given. But with what's going on right now, not just in our nation, but globally with the novel coronavirus, COVID-19. And we don't want to discuss, you know, numbers, because between the time that we're recording this to the time that it gets released, and then by the time someone hears it, maybe a week after it gets put out, obviously all the numbers are going to change. But I just wanted to get your perspective on really just the differences of how, and it goes back to those stretched resources, but rural communities are going to be affected differently, are going to handle things differently, and just speak to, I mean, maybe some of those are, it gives us advantages, some maybe gives us disadvantages, but it's certainly different. And the news media is going to focus, at least right now, it seems, a lot more on metropolitan areas, the big cities, because that's where the bigger numbers are. But just talk about how rural communities have to handle it differently and maybe affect it differently with something that this is certainly unprecedented as a global pandemic, but it's happening and here we are.
I'm going to charge you with keeping me focused and on task then. Let me just say that the biggest challenge is we really don't know very much at all about this particular organism, about this virus. We're being educated on a day-to-day basis, and that's what I hear from my colleagues in Atlanta, Columbus, Columbia, South Carolina, Gainesville, Florida, is that they're learning on the fly, that we are learning on the fly, that we really have no historical information to rely on, that this is not just the common flu, as some folks have said. We are all susceptible because until the outbreak in, and I know it's not politically correct to say the China virus from Wuhan, China, but until that outbreak actually occurred, we had no scientific information whatsoever, no knowledge of this organism. And it has the ability to change in short periods of time as well. So the treatment will evolve over time as it has, knowing that, as everybody's heard, that there's really no proven treatment to treat the virus or to eradicate the disease process. I think the advantages in small communities are just that. We're smaller. We're not population dense. We don't have a lot of foot traffic. And I think that's definitely an advantage. We tend to know each other, maybe care, and I have to be careful in saying this, maybe care a little bit more intensely knowing each other as well as we do than in large metropolitan areas where, yes, you know the guy on the other side of New York City, but only in passing. And we, you know, we carry on daily activities. We go to church, we shop with, we shop for, we help out our neighbors. That's just who we are, what we do. So advantages, disadvantages. I do not think that we're shielded from this virus. I think it's going to hit, as we already have experienced. We know that we have cases, not just in nearby communities that are stressing the healthcare resources, but we've had cases right here in Ben Hill and Irwin County. So the things that I'm concerned about are the limited resources that we have available. We have two hospitals, limited beds. We have no critical care specialist. We have no infectious disease specialist. We have no pulmonologist in either hospital. We have a couple of general surgeons, some OBGYN docs. We do have some emergency room docs that man each of the hospital's emergency department, basically generalists like myself, right, whether internal medicine or family medicine, that provide inpatient care and the outpatient care, but a very limited number of those. A good friend of mine, a colleague up in Fitzgerald, Dr. Tom Mann, he's the medical director of the hospitalist program, is very concerned about his small list of hospitalists being overwhelmed by the burden, the disease burden, and the severity of the burden. We do have access to an ICU at Dormady Medical Center. Irwin County does not have an ICU, but we do have respiratory isolation. We do have a nursing staff that is capable. There are two or three primary care docs on staff. That tells the tale right there. We definitely have limited resources. Yeah. I think there may be five, at the most, six physicians in Fitzgerald as well. If the burden of the disease becomes as large as some people are saying, including Dr. Fossey, who is the head of the infectious disease specialty nationwide, and most of your listeners would have probably seen him on television.
Yes.
But he's concerned, and the number of, not just the number of contacts and the number of patients ill, but the death toll, and we're not going to list numbers because it's changing, and we simply don't know.
Right.
But my fear, just like Dr. Mann's fear, is the lack of resources, and eventually we're going to be fatigued, absolutely fatigued. And when you run out of doctors, you run out of nurses who are either become ill themselves or they're exhausted beyond the point of being able to care for the sick people. If the numbers are as large as what some people are saying, I think that's what we all fear the most.
And the spike, I imagine, if it just comes all at once, that's this flatten the curve idea.
Right.
Yeah.
And no one wants to talk about rationing care. No one wants to talk about picking and choosing who gets the ventilator, who does not get the ventilator. Right.
Well, we're already seeing things in the news where hospitals are having to have those conversations, those contingency plans. And of course, that's a terrible thought, but it ends up being a practical and realistic one.
And it's a terrible exercise. Who has the capacity to make that
right
decision on an individual basis?
Yeah. Because the doctors want to, and the nurses and everybody involved in care are wanting to help everybody.
Going back to my focus on my education and training, it was very easy back in those days that you take care of the patient that's in front of you at the time, and you do the very best you possibly can do, and you get it right every time. That has relaxed a little bit over the decades that I've been in practice with the and I don't mean this as an insult to my business colleagues and friends and neighbors, but with the business takeover of medicine, the bottom line has surpassed the relationship and the need to get it right. Get it close to right, but generate a bottom line that we can live with. And so it's most of medicine has become encounter-based and not individually based. And the encounters are to do the best you can, be sure that you get it right most of the time. But some of us, old people like me, still think I have to get it right. I have to get it absolutely correct and hit the ball out of the park. You know, I've got to hit a home run every at bat. That's a tough requirement for most of us.
Sure.
I certainly struggle with that.
As we kind of close this out, I'm going to ask a real broad question, and you answer it however, whatever comes to mind.
Sure.
You've already alluded to things that have changed over the course of your medical career. And then, you know, in talking about what we're unprepared for in the current crisis, as we close out, just either a trend you've seen, whether they're good, whether not so good, or things that just need to change in medicine. You're just drawn from so much education, so much networking at not only the state, but the national level. You know, when you're asked by a national magazine to interview because your perspective is seen as a pretty good one, and you got to speak on behalf of a lot of people through that opportunity, of course. What have you seen that's changed over time, whether it was for good or for bad, and what maybe needs to change in the next 30 or 40 years in medicine?
I think we need to take a step backwards and put more focus on our patients and what we're doing. It's the technology, and I'm not knocking technology. It has tremendous benefits. But the focus the pendulum has swung too far in the direction of technology. It's still the practice of medicine, and that's why it's still called the practice of medicine, not necessarily the pure science of medicine. Yeah. And I think as this pandemic is demonstrating, we don't have a lot of scientific knowledge to base our decision-making and our treatment on. But the practice of medicine is still as basic as an educated, trained, healthcare human being taking care of a fellow human being for whatever they come in with, whatever problem they're having, and our obligation is to do the best that we can for them. In this age of encounter-based and volume-driven medicine, healthcare, bottom line, profit, so that we can be bought out by a larger health system, to be bought out by another larger health system, so we can all become filthy rich, I think is contrary to what most of us went to medical school to do. But easily swayed when you get caught in, it's like getting in a riptide at the beach, if you will. Once you get in that riptide, you're going to be pulled out to sea unless you know how to escape out of one of the lateral boundaries, if you will. But those are my concerns, and I'm not decrying the need for technology. I think technology is a boon. I think too much focus on technology overplaying hands-on human skills and the relationship that one has with their patient.
Well, Dr. Howard McMahon, thanks first for being our small town doc in the great city of Ocala, Georgia. And thanks
Amen.
For joining us on.
It is a great city.
It is a great city.
For those of you who've never visited, I too will invite you to come visit our little hamlet.
There we go.
It's a very, very nice community.
Good plug. Dr. Mack, thanks for joining us on Small Town Podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Small Town Podcast is supported by the Southern Mercantile. Visit southernmercantile.com for a blog about small town living and an online store with a selection of carefully curated goods. The Southern Mercantile. Simple living, Southern charm. Now, while this episode was certainly on a very serious topic, I still asked my standard get-to-know-you questions of Dr. Mack, and he did not disappoint with his answers. All right. So, Dr. Mack, I've got a section of the interview I always do called the get to know you questions. So I've got four questions to help me get to know you a little better. Even though we know each other, I bet I'm going to learn something new from these. So first question, do you have or have you ever had a nickname? Now, I know you go by Dr. Mack, so, because I already introduced you as that, but any other nicknames?
Yes.
All right. I see the smile. This one's going to be good.
Well, one is embarrassing. One is one most people could guess, Howie.
Okay.
That's right. Howard. As a little boy, Howie was my nickname forever. Some high school buddies, you may not want to hear the whole story, but I'm known to my handful, 8 or 10 high school buddies as Top Hat.
All right. What's the story behind Top Hat?
The story behind Top Hat was that a number of us were in the same Sunday school class together. Most of you will recall the county fairs and the state fairs in various communities. And Augusta was known for the Exchange Club Fair. And as teenagers, underage teenagers, 17, I think I was 16 at the time, 16 and some of my buddies, 17 and 18 years of age. Anyway, we went to the fair. And every city or county fair had somewhat of a risque event or show. And in Augusta, in that particular year, I think I was a junior in high school, the quote, and I mean, no disparaging to the fairer sex, but a girly show. Of course, it was very mild by today's standards, but very mild. But it was a little bit of a
But for a 16-year-old young man, yeah.
Eye-opening. Well... But my buddies had been before, and they it was a setup. So they here's this goody-two-shoes young friend of theirs, and so they took him into the show, and we stayed for a few minutes and then left and didn't think anything about it until the following morning. That was Saturday night. So Sunday morning, I walk into the Sunday school class, and two of those three guys were in my Sunday school class, and they said, Top Hat, you made it today. Of course, I turned 14 shades of red, and the Sunday school teacher wanted to know how I got my nickname, Top Hat.
And if anyone can't figure that out, just listen to the story again and try to use your imagination.
And I'm still, and one of those, we named our youngest son after him, Benji Moore. Benji was a great friend of mine all in eighth grade on. He finished second in class. I was valedictorian of our senior class, and Benji finished 2/100ths of a point behind my accumulative total.
Oh, wow.
He actually...
Photo finish there.
He had more sports athletic points. I had more academic and leadership points, but we were neck and neck. But he went on to become... He played baseball at Middle Georgia, played for the national title his second year in junior college. He also played at Georgia Southern and recently had his number retired. Alongside of Dennis Dove, one of the local Irwin Countyans. Benji played at Harlem High School, was a second baseman drafted by the Brewers, and was a honorable mention All-American at Georgia Southern his senior year in high school.
And when you see him now, he still calls you Top Hat?
He still calls me Top Hat.
Top Hat. All right. All right, Howie. Next question. What would be your go-to karaoke song?
I don't have one.
Well, let's come up with one. If we went out, did a little karaoke right now, what would the song you'd want to go first? Oh, a favorite song you'd want to sing with the words right there?
No, I don't have one.
All right. I got a question later that might help. We'll pass on that one. We'll come back to it. Easy one here. What is your favorite meal or favorite dish?
You're not going to believe this either, but I don't have a single favorite. If I had to claim one.
Yes, you have to claim one.
I would claim duck and andouille etouffee, but it has to be Arkansas harvested mallard duck that I have cleaned and I have brined and I have taken care of myself and with a nice spicy etouffee and good hard crusted French bread.
That's a pretty specific thing. You said you had no favorite and then you came up with that.
In a glass of a nice cab to go with it.
Well, there we go. That sounds pretty good. Now I want to go to Arkansas with you. Well, I was going to say final question, but we're coming back to the karaoke song. If you could attend any concert of any singer, duo, band, performer of any kind, but they can either be someone that is now dead or alive, whose concert would you want to see? Whose performance?
Mark Knopfler.
Mark Knopfler.
Okay. Dire Straits.
Okay. Does that help you with the karaoke song now? Money for Nothing?
Everybody knows that one. So I guess okay. I can claim that. No, there you go. One of my favorites is Dire Straits' Telegraph Road.
Dire Straits, Telegraph Road.
For people get bored with that. It's so long, and it's the instrumental is just really, really nice. My brother and I, a couple of friends at Duck Hunt in Arkansas, we spent many a night road trip driving all night to get to Arkansas just to hunt ducks for a day and a half and then drive all the way back. But to get us through the Mississippi and Arkansas Delta, we would play a lot of Knopfler, and that was one of our favorite because it was a long instrumental.
Yeah.
And the guy driving, the other guys would sleep, and the guy driving just had to turn it up real loud and drive across the Delta.
Well, probably not the best for karaoke with a lot of instrumental, but we'll go with it unless you got another one.
That's it.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Mike.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, small towners, that'll do it for this episode of Small Town Podcast. I want to thank Dr. Howard McMahon for talking with me. I hope everyone will stay safe and healthy by taking the necessary precautions that we all need to exercise in these unprecedented circumstances. As always, I want to thank our season sponsors for Season 3, the Georgia Municipal Association, Consolidated Pipe, the Southern Mercantile, and our newest season sponsor, Public Software, for supporting us as we explore and share great small towns. I'll talk to you soon, and normally I'd say y'all are welcome to come to Osceola anytime, but right now, I hope you'll stay home and stay safe right where you are.
Small Town Podcast is an Irwinomics production. We release new episodes every other week featuring small towns through stories of the people who live and lead there. Our podcast episodes are made possible with editing assistance from Resonate Recordings, who also mixes and masters all of our episodes. You can subscribe to Small Town Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and the next episode will download while you sleep. You can also leave us a rating and review, which would help us reach new listeners. We would really appreciate it. Beyond our episodes, you can engage with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also learn more about us and the small towns we visit by visiting our website, www.smalltownpodcast.com. We'd love to show all you small towners out there some great images from the small towns we visit and let you know about the festivals and events you can participate in. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you real soon because there's no place like Osceola, Georgia.
We stand adjourned.